Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Are we recording? Are we recording now?
I'm recording, yeah.
He's been doing the stretches.
Yeah.
So why did we watch this?
Well, so
it's not a horror film, and it was moderately shot in Britain, horrific bits.
Well, I was thinking
I've seen more horrific bits in like The Bill.
I think yeah. I was watching at Christmas time. There was a lot of home stuff on Twitter, and I think yes. I put a thing on Twitter saying, "Are there any homes films which could legitimately be seen as horror films?" And I think this is the one which was like the consensus of opinion amongst people on Twitter.
And how many people was that a consensus between, please?
I can't
three?
Remember now. Probably three people.
Yeah, you can.
Two or three people, something like that.
Great.
Yeah. So I just thought,
I'm gonna find those three people personally and I'm gonna kill them.
Is that your decree?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well. It's not horror.
No.
It's not British.
It is. It's a British co-production.
Well, it's as British as like Raiders of the Lost Ark is British or something like that. That was filmed mainly in Britain, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So can we do one on Raiders of the Lost Ark? That's got more horror in it than this.
Yeah, we could do. It's at the back end of the long ever growing list.
Need to do a Quatermass because I see there's a lot of Quatermass stuff bubbling under, isn't there, on social media?
They're doing a live thing, aren't they?
Is this 75 years of Quatermass?
Of the first one, yeah. We haven't done the first one yet. So,
well, that's the one we should do, because that's the best. Well, the film, we can't do the TV one, because I don't... Does it exist? I don't even know, actually.
The film's brilliant. We could do the live one, couldn't we?
Yeah. I'm wondering why my eyes look so small and...
Which is so far away.
I look awful tonight.
Oh, God, I just look at myself in the mirror. Right.
Right, okay.
Should we get into it?
All right, let's do this.
Here we go.
Britain. An ancient kingdom with legends of violence, cruelty, and torment in its blood. Join your hosts, Ross, John, and James, as they bravely tread where few would dare. Witness their journey into the horrific history of British horror. They are... The General Witchfinders.
Ladies and gentlemen, goblins and ghouls, welcome back once again to the 37th episode of the General Witchfinders podcast. I'm James in Bournemouth in southern England.
I'm John Pountney, aging rapidly by the hour by the sound of it. If we've done 37 of these, that's at least 134 hours we've probably spent doing this podcast.
Yeah.
If we spent 2 hours per episode.
If you think it takes me... double or three times as long to edit each one.
Christ.
Yeah, you love it, Ross.
I'm John Pountney. don't complain.
It's all I live for.
Yeah. I'm John Pountney. I'm still alive, and I'm in South Wales, which is still in the south of Wales.
And I'm Ross in Dorchester in southern England, and this time we witnessed murder by
London,
murder, by
1888. The fogs of autumn have settled in. Silence hovers over the city. Not the silence of night, but the silence of fear and murder. Murder by decree. Something stalks the streets. Something possessed of animal cunning and fury. Something nameless and incomprehensible. Out of the vortex of murder spins an ever-spiraling web of bizarre clues. Only one man can unravel that web. That man is Sherlock Holmes.
I understand you know something of the Whitechapel murders.
I have seen the man known as Jack the Ripper.
You found the body then? It was in this posture, just as it is now.
Yes.
Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson plunge into the Victorian underworld, seeking the answers to the most puzzling case in the annals of crime. Who is Jack the Ripper?
There is not now, nor has there ever been a danger to the monarchy. That thought existed only in the minds of the three men in this room. Your intrigue simply served the disaffected radicals.
Why is the Prime Minister of England interested in this case? Why are agents of the Crown killing witnesses?
Food for thought. And why feed us information in such a bizarre fashion? And more important still, who killed Mickens and why?
The official word is that the Ripper is a madman. If that is so, why is Scotland Yard trying to stop Holmes' investigation?
Why does he let them keep you here?
I don't know!
Who is the woman weeping in the asylum? What is it that generates such fear and passion? At last, Sherlock Holmes knows the answers, and the weight of a nation is brought to bear against him to keep him from revealing the incredible truth. Christopher Plummer and James Mason in definitive performances as the master detective and his faithful friend Watson. In a story inspired by 10 years of research that at last reveals the identity of history's most elusive murderer. A conclusion that has shocked the world. An answer too bizarre to be true. A stunning cast brought together with an astonishing story set against the sweep and grandeur of Victorian London to bring you one of the great screen entertainments in the classic tradition, Murder by Decree.
So, Murder by Decree is a 1979 mystery thriller directed by Bob Clark, the director of director of Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things and Dead of Night, not the brilliant black and white British film from 1945, which we featured in episode 13, but the 1974 American film where a young soldier killed in the Vietnam War inexplicably shows up at his family home on the night of his death. He also directed Black Christmas, Porky's, as we discussed, and we may come on to this again later, and Porky's 2, as well as The Karate Dog and Super Babies, Baby Geniuses 2. Jesus cruelly Christ. Pipped for the Palme d'Or that year, yeah. I believe, by Roman Polanski's Revulsion.
Yeah. I reckon Roman Polanski would have been into Baby Geniuses.
A little bit of satire. Right, so Murder by Decree was written by playwright John Hopkins, who scripted the Bond film Thunderball. Of course, remade as Never Say Never Again. That, you know, never, because of that.
Never Say Never Again. Never on TV yesterday, and made me reassess what I thought about Tenet. And I thought Never Say Never Again was a better film than Tenet.
I would agree with that.
The much more glamorous use of speedboats and big yachts. And I just thought, this is better than Tenet. It's got more charm. Yeah. It's got the Bond girl in the Renault 5 that explodes, but there's only her shoes left.
Yeah, I can't remember her. And Tenet ended before you even got the part in Doctor Who, didn't it? So that joke would have been better if I
Right, okay.
Got it right. I will cut that out. That's the end of shit. All right, carry on.
Okay. Thanks.
And I got two.
David Tennant.
Tennant. Oh, Tennant. Tennant. It was a poor pun, John. It was a poor pun.
It was really, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, cut that out.
So, yeah.
And the Alec Guinness TV version of Smiley's People. Hopkins referenced Conan Doyle's work, allegedly, particularly Holmes' deduction and science skills. We'll talk about that in a bit. Not really, but downplayed other aspects of the characters, such as Holmes' drug use, in favour of making them more likeable and human, and with a very wacky sense of humour.
It's a very, very strange sort of depiction of Holmes, I thought.
Oh, gosh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Peter O'Toole was originally cast. Lawrence of Arabia himself was originally cast as Sherlock Holmes, and Sir Laurence Larry Olivier was cast as Dr. Watson. But the two actors had not worked well together in the past. Ooh, that sounds worthy of a bit of a deep dive. Mm. And were unable to overcome their differences for this movie. In other words, paycheck not big enough.
Yeah.
Rather, Holmes is played by Christopher Captain Von Trapp Plummer. And Dr. Watson is played by James Mason. And I've made a note of this. I said, like, does everyone, do you guys do a James Mason? If you do a James Mason impression, you just say his name. James Mason.
I thought he's the only high point in this entire film.
I thought he was brilliant.
So, Plummer describes...
That wasn't a part then, by the way.
Uh-huh. Okay. Right, okay, Plummer, described by IMDb as perhaps Canada's greatest thespian, turned down the role of Gandalf in Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy, which I don't know how much of this is of relevance to what we're talking about here.
I'm just padding out.
Clearly, there's got a lot of padding going on here. Yeah. Right, and then it says...
2 hours of material.
Yeah.
Questions for James and John? Question mark? Christopher Plummer had two roles in common with Peter Cushing. Can you name them? No. John?
Well, I presume, did he play Sherlock Holmes?
Yes, correct.
Okay. And did he play Van Helsing?
Yeah, he was Van Helsing in Dracula 2000.
Okay.
I had something. I was grasping for something then, but then I forgot. Peter Cushing, the mention of Peter Cushing just sidetracked me.
Just made you feel a little bit happier about doing this podcast.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about his hair in Dracula AD 1972, and then the revelation that we think that it might have been a wig all along.
That does mean that wig may exist somewhere, and you may get to wear it one day.
I don't need to wear a wig, Cleve. I did read on Wikipedia, of course, that the original TV series and book that this was based on was written by a man from Camamon, which is where the Stereophonics also come from.
Ooh.
Which is pretty high-end knowledge, isn't it?
Yeah.
I can't remember his name, but he was at the BBC the same time as Sidney Newman, TV's Doctor Who creator, showrunner in modern parlance.
Is it?
And they worked together as colleagues, and then I think he...
Stephen Knight.
I was about to say, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that's what it says down here. He wrote the book, The Final Solution.
And no, it's not that one.
Oh, okay.
It's a Welsh name, like Emlyn.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Hang on.
Well, I was going to say more on that, and also, dear listeners, more on that shortly, because I'm holding in my left hand a copy of Alan Moore's From Hell. Yes. And not the collected one. Oh, no. Like the comic book guy in The Simpsons, I have all the original issues. So this is the epilogue, Dance of the Gold Catchers, which will be of interest to us shortly.
Yes. Oh, I reread the first half of From Hell.
Yeah.
As a
brilliant
preparation for this.
Okay. Back to your introduction, Ross.
Yes.
Okay. So it says James Mason reportedly once saved the life of Max Bygrave's son at a party at Judy Garland's house. Wow. The boy fell into the pool and Max did not notice. James Mason did. That's a bit of shade on that. Yeah. I want to tell you a story while my son drowned. So James Mason did, and fully clothed, jumped into the water and pulled him out. He was scheduled to pay his... I didn't say pulled him off, sorry.
Oh, yeah, no, that's Barrymore.
Hey! He was scheduled to play James... There's a lot of that already tonight. He was scheduled to play James Bond in a 1958 television adaptation of From Russia with Love, which was ultimately never produced. Later,
what's Max Bygrave's? You're a pink toothbrush.
I'm a yellow toothbrush. I wrote. Do you know Max Bygrave wrote the introduction to the infamous autobiography of the Crankies?
No,
that one. Yeah. When they revealed that they were swingers, and that's when lately when people got those t-shirts saying "I swang with the Crankies."
Whoa!
Yeah. Anyway, that's the aside that people listen to this podcast.
Yeah. What's
for.
Max Bygraves? Did he live in Bournemouth?
He did, Ross.
Yeah. It was Max Bygraves and Keith Harris. Who was like,
yes,
you might
yes.
see them yes. at some point.
This yes. is what I was mentioning you to you two the other night when Frankie Howard was on. Mm. That it brought the seed of the memory back into my yes. mind that I'd heard. Vaguely apocryphal stories about Frankie Howard in yes. the late 90s, which I slightly misremembered. But yeah, Max Bygraves was on talking about Frankie Howard. While Frankie Howard was still alive, very obviously swerving any mention of the fact that Frankie Howard was a homosexual, telling stories about, to remember his lines at night. He'd go out walking, and he'd end up in cemeteries, and he'd be there sat on a gravestone, and I'd say, "What were you doing in that cemetery, Frankie?" And he's like, "I was rehearsing my lines."
anyway, right? Okay, so let's try and get this vehicle back onto the road here, right? Yeah. So what it says though is later, despite being in his 50s, Mason was a contender to play Bond in Doctor No. Before, yes. of course, Sean Connery was cast. Mm. He later turned down the role of Hugo Drax in the James Bond film Moonraker, which went to Michael Lonsdale. Yeah. Yeah. In his autobiography, In Spite of Myself, Plummer noted that Mason was the best Watson he had ever seen and that his death halted a proposed furthering of their on-screen partnership. I wonder if they would have solved any other real-life crimes. Yeah.
We're not really solved. Just
Hindley and Brady.
Yeah. Oh, God. The Yorkshire Ripper.
Yeah. You know. Well, they should have basically just done a series of Ripper-themed
movies. Yeah.
Peter Sutcliffe. The writer of the original material is called Elwin Jones, who was born in 1923, 100 years ago, in Camamon. Created Zed Cars, Softly, 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 Task Force, and then he did a thing called Jack the Ripper, which I've never heard of, where Stratford Johns and Frank Windsor, the characters from Zed Cars, playing slightly different roles, basically the same roles under different names, reinvestigate the Jack the Ripper crimes. I'd love to watch this. It sounds absolutely mental. So it's basically a fictional drama about two characters from Zed Cars with slightly different names reinvestigating. What have you got, James?
Well, I was about to say, from Dance of the Gold Catchers, right? If I hold it up, you see there's a screenshot from it, John.
Really? Yeah. I can see Stratford Johns there, yeah.
Yeah, and what it says, what Alan Moore says, is the following year. The following year, the BBC broadcast a drama documentary, Jack the Ripper, in which fictional TV detectives Watt and Barlow ruminate upon the murders. So there's our first crossover.
So yeah, he was the man that kind of originated the idea for this film, but not the idea of Jack the Ripper versus
Sherlock Holmes.
Because that was a film called Study in Terror, which was made in 1965.
What? Again, maybe we could have done that one.
Right. Okay. So the film also features David Hemmings, who, of course, is my best known for Blow Up. Which, weirdly enough, I found out, odd aside, I only found out years later, the famous. Okay, John, John would have said, John, you've seen Blow Up, haven't you?
Not for a long time.
Oh. Well, you know,
maybe
he famously
about 23 years.
he takes a picture of a woman in the park, there's a murder in the background or what have you.
Where he takes
the picture of her was around the corner from where I lived in my third year as an undergraduate. I only found out years later. Literally, I could have walked there in 30 seconds. I was like, I had no idea.
You could have probably written an article about that for Sight and Sound, James.
I bloody could, John. Anyway, always in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Sorry, Kim Ewan's just put one of those in this morning, so sorry, you've...
No, Damn it. Anyway, so yeah, so David Hemmings was also in Deep Red, Barbarella, of course, and then Gladiator. But and then Ross has also mentioned that he was in Magnum PI and Elf. I don't think when he sort of shuffles off this mortal coil, people will be talking about his guests.
He's got his long on, James.
Is he? Okay, yeah, well, that's news to me. Well, there you are.
Yeah, he was very bloated at the end.
Oh, wow. Well, there you are. All right, so the curse of the movie Gladiator and people getting bloated up continues.
Right. Well, a lot of people got hurt in the making the sequel, aren't they? The other day.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's cursed.
Yeah.
Cursed. We don't get cursed movies anymore. No. I used to enjoy a good old cursed movie when the people used to go on about that. But anyway, and then it's also got Anthony Quayle, who's in Lawrence of Arabia and The Guns of Navarone, as Sir Charles Warren.
Sporting some amazing.
Amazing. Hair. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And looking very frightened at all times.
Yes. And then Frank Finlay, who was in Life Force and The Three Musketeers, as Inspector Lestrade. Mm. And then Genevieve Bujold, in a very odd turn, as Annie Crook, the pivotal character in this piece. Susan Clark as Mary Kelly and lovey John Gielgud. They didn't get Larry Olivier, but they did get Johnny Gielgud in.
Steals it at the end.
Yeah. He comes in to classy up the production, doesn't he? As Prime Minister Lord Salisbury. And then, of course, there is also Donald Sutherland as Robert Lees.
Who at the start is uncredited. Is that right? He's not in the credits at the start of the film.
I'm not sure.
Because when he turned up in the film, I was like, what the fuck? I haven't seen Donald Sutherland's name. He looks like he's off his tits on acid.
As usual. And I also think he looks like he was in the band Kings of Leon. he looks like from the early years of the Kings of Leon. He
so
looks
like he's fun.
His sex is on fire. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's and a lot then, of syphilis about back then, wasn't there?
Yeah. And then Ross has also noted that the mighty June Brown appears as Annie Chapman. And
really?
June Brown, of course, was Dot Cotton from EastEnders.
Yeah, apparently so. But I didn't notice her. But
I didn't notice her. I did see one policeman who was Pete Beale.
Oh, yes.
From TV's EastEnders.
Yeah.
One look at this cast list and I thought the phrase, big drinkers. And I just thought every night after they'd wrapped, they were all going down the pub, weren't they? And they
said that Christopher Plummer did film some of his scenes pissed.
I bet. You can tell. Yeah, you can tell because suddenly he'll either crack up or go mental.
He's constantly on the verge of laughing.
Yeah.
All these men were massive, massive drinkers. Like drinkers that the kind of drinkers we don't see anymore. Recently I went to a wedding actually, and there was a guy there and we all reckoned on him sinking at least 20 pints.
Wow.
Before, and we left before him where there were three full pints in front of him still, and he was on shots.
How do you afford that now, though?
No idea. He was a giant of a man. He made you look like a child, Cleves. I've never seen such a monster. His head was like a mini.
Was it Dave Press?
He looked like he was like Jaws. I think he was Irish.
The Irish Jaws.
Yeah, the Irish Jaws.
Right, so just to finish off, and also this will be a present.
But we still haven't finished the intro.
Oh, we haven't gone through the introduction yet, John. There's a lot
Jesus
going on.
Christ.
Right, so just about this is it. The final paragraphs, everybody. So it says, the film's premise of the plot behind the murders is influenced by the book Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution by Stephen Knight, who presumed that the killings were part of a Masonic plot. And quick pause here, and for me to put in, I've already mentioned it, this is also the main text cited and used by Alan Moore and Eddie Campbell in their version of the Ripper story, From Hell. So interesting, right? Along with their other big influence as well is Whitechapel Scarlet Tracings by Ian Sinclair, but that's neither here nor there. Right, so it says the original script contained the names of historical subjects, Sir William Gull and John Netley. So William Gull is the man who they believe actually was Jack the Ripper, the royal surgeon, and John Netley, who was the coachman. In the actual film, they are represented by fictional analogues, Thomas Spivey, Gull and William Slade for Netley. The theory on the perpetrators of the killings is featured in another number of other Jack the Ripper themed fictions, including, as Ross says, From Hell. To give an idea of what other films were contemporary to this, in a documentary on the making of The Shining, James Mason and his wife, Clarissa K. Mason, pays a visit to their old friend Stanley Kubrick, who had directed Mason in Lolita, of course. During the filming of this movie, when both movies were in production at Elstree. In this documentary, Mason can be seen wearing his Dr. Watson costume. Ah. While Kubrick is in his iconic parka.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Shuffling constantly. Around.
You can imagine James Mason going up to him and saying, "You won't believe the fucking shit."
What's this? It is. While I'm making a psychological horror that people will be talking about in 3 decades' time, they'll even do a documentary about it. I'm doing a film that basically has no plot.
And I've had to write my own scene about a pee.
That scene. I thought it was going to hinge on that scene.
Later. No.
And it was like, that's going to be an insight into like the mind of like Jack the Ripper or something. But no, it was just never mentioned again.
Yeah. And so
until
it then says
40 years later when three middle-aged
knackered men. Right. So it says the replica 19th century Dockland set, which was very impressive. Yeah.
I could watch a
lot of money
just on that fucking set. It was amazing.
Yeah. Took 2 months and 50 men to construct at Shepperton Studios' largest soundstage. The set also included a replica muddy Thames River. And also, simultaneously, Alien was being shot, which is mad. If you think about how Alien looks and how this movie... This film looks
this
like
is a David
Peace
novel
older.
That needs to be written, isn't
it? Yes, it does.
The Shining, Alien, and this all being... Oh, that's brilliant.
That's
I'm going to write this.
That's why I wanted to bring that up, because I was thinking... I wrote down, this is a real film. It looks like it's been well shot and everything. But then you think, what it was contemporary to, it's old-fashioned
it's made
alongside it.
Incredibly old-fashioned.
Yes.
It's not even... It's old-fashioned, but it doesn't have the tropes of, say, a Hammer version, which I was expecting, like gaudy colours and Dutch angles and loads of blood and like cleavage and it's just got nothing. It's really, and like I've said, it doesn't get going until the 90th minute.
But imagine at the cinema, you go, "What do you want to go and watch? The Shining, Alien, or Murder by Decree?" They are so. It's like if someone showed me and said, you know, I would say they're about 15 years apart. You know,
yeah,
it's insane.
Yeah.
It's a very strange film.
So let's get into it. Let's get going. So we start off with, and I've put London in my notes.
Yeah.
A la like the start of Danger Mouse. They go for that kind of classic Victoriana.
The sprawling metropolis
of London at
Someone
the start.
Someone was very, very proud of the model of London they made.
Yes, we get a lot of shots of that.
It's a lot of screen time, but it looks more like Tudor London than Victorian London to me. It's a really weird London where... It's just flat, except for like Tower Bridge. Yeah. It's just, there's nothing there.
And Big Ben, which is apparently just near Whitechapel, you know.
Yeah.
It's literally
spitting distance. Yeah.
And then you have the titles come in the most lurid, a Palmer violet shade of like, you
gothic
can't call
font,
it purple.
Isn't it?
It's like a violet, like a gothic font. It's absolutely.
Yes.
And it's the most horrifying thing in the film, to be fair.
Is that these days it's a font most associated with really chavvy tattoos.
Yep.
you need to get like your child's name.
Yeah. Speaking of which, we almost run a kid over today because he dropped out in front of the car
right.
as we came in the corner, and the mum was like, "Maverick!"
So
I said, imagine if we killed a kid called Maverick.
Maverick.
Did you not double back on yourself and just finish him off for being called Maverick?
But you suppose you can't expect anything else from a kid called Maverick, can you? Just...
No, that's true.
Well, yeah.
He's out there. Right, so our story begins in the kind of, they give you like the foggy London town atmospheric setup.
Mm,
but
yes.
The stop kicks in with the Royal Opera House.
Mm, yes.
Although I've noted... That's not the Royal Opera House. My sister, my brilliant sister Kate, worked at the Royal Opera House in the 1990s. And
no
I'd
way.
Often go and meet her. Yeah. And I'd go and meet her there for lunch. And I'll tell you right now, that's not the Royal Opera House, wherever that is. It looked more like Charing Cross Station. It's not.
Yeah.
I was like, that's not the Opera House. Anyway, and then we go in and we find that, first of all, I've noticed that there's a ridiculously oversized Union Jack.
Yeah. Which is sort of thing you had, John had pegged up in that
college.
Church hall when we was at college, where he had his crucified on.
Yeah, that's okay. Right. And we then see, we're introduced to Holmes and Watson, who are taking in a night at the opera. And when Prince Eddie, heir to the throne, turns up, the proletariat start booing him.
Booing.
He starts getting booed, and we're told
in
it's
the
because
cheap
he.
Seats.
Yeah, well, then we're told that he can't keep it in his trousers. And what I've put is, well, you know, it's that well-known bastion of the proletariat, the Royal Opera House. Even the cheap seats, you need to have a mortgage to go to.
It makes no sense at all. But we're also introduced to Holmes and Watson at this point, and they mention Lestrade in a way that kind of presumes, I thought, that the audience already knows who everyone is in this film.
I think one of the things they put in the marketing for this film, this is the 137th feature film about Holmes and Watson. So I think they can kind of sort of assume people know.
We don't need an origin.
It's quite weird. I just thought that was weird that it was like, it's like you pick up from somewhere else, from another like adventure or something, which at that point charmed me. Mm. But then as the film progressed, I was like, God.
But you immediately, for me, it was like, well, this is a different kind of Holmes that I'm used to. I'm kind of used to the kind of a little bit autistic,
a good one.
Kind of a little bit standoffish, a little bit frightening, you know.
Yeah.
But this is just like a version
bon
of
vivre.
Home. Yeah, he's just constantly like smirking to himself and taking the piss out of everyone. Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe a little bit pissed, but I don't know if that's more plumber than Holmes.
Than anything else. Well, also, I noticed, as I was watching it, I did think, oh, this might be quite good, you know, quite thin gruel here we're having to consume. And just I thought, people booing the Royal Opera House, people booing at the Royal Opera House. Why is that clicking something in my mind? And I went through the old mental Rolodex, i.e. the internet, and I checked, I was like, that's it. And I thought our audience might enjoy this. So from 10th of November, 2022, audience member banned from the Royal Opera House after he loudly booed child singer during Harriet. Yes! And it says, Covent Garden said it was appalled by the behaviour of a heckler who disrupted the opening night performance of a 12-year-old singer in Handel's Alcinea. The Royal Opera House has announced an individual is banned from attending their theatre following a disruption. It says Macaulay Mbayo was on the Covent Garden stage debuting in the role of Oberto in the opera. The young singer was performing an aria in the second act when the audience member sitting in the house's amphitheatre began to heckle. Before the end of his aria, as Bayo exited the stage, the man shouted, "Rubbish!" and loudly booed. After initial gasps in disbelief at the outburst, the opera house quickly erupted in loud and sustained cheering and applause for the young singer.
They did start going, "God save his Royal Highness."
Royal Highness, yeah, but that's what I mean. It was some of that. Yeah. And it has, and you know, since the, you know, the guy's been banned for life, but the whole kind of boo rubbish at the Royal Opera House, so that, you know, I thought people might find that entertaining, but anyway, there you go. So after this, it then cuts to, doesn't it? Bang. We cut back to what I put, Ripper Cam.
Yes.
From Jack the Ripper's point of view.
So I quite like this bit because this is probably the most horror bit in it. It's like the fisheye lens, the Jaws music playing as a sort of like the Ripper sort of breathing as he's sort of looking through his for his victim.
And he's got weird eyes, hasn't he? I thought it was like,
not sure why he's got weird eyes. Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Like huge contact lenses.
Yeah. Yes. Never referred to again.
No. No. Odd. And then, yeah, so we see him strike.
Does he kill anyone?
He does. Yeah.
Yeah, he strangles some old lady, but they slow her down, so she ends up like...
Oh, yes! Yeah, this is what I said here. Injudicious use of slow motion, which they never use again either, do they, at this point?
And the same with like the POV, that sort of comes and goes as well. Sometimes you see that.
Well, they use a POV, but then when he's strangling the woman, she doesn't look into the camera, which is meant to be his eyes. She looks to one side, which doesn't make sense. Oh, for God's sake.
But although there are two killers, so she might be looking at the...
Don't give away the twist, Cleve, which isn't even like signposted as a twist.
All mentioned after it's revealed.
Because it's like, well, there's two Jack the Rippers. That's quite a good twist, isn't it? But actually, they're just like, blah, 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 in a courtroom at the end, and then it's like, bye-bye.
Holmes has a cry, and they play some sad music.
Music, yeah. Which is weirdly discordant. Yeah. We'll get onto the music later, inevitably. Right, so then what happens is, so the opera kicks out, and a thing which I'm not sure ever used to happen, newspapermen run up to members of the audience while they're still in the opera
with flyers and give them away. They're not taking money.
You noticed that as well. I put the only person who paid for them is Watson, the sucker. Yeah. Everyone else takes one.
I really like this Watson, though. I think he's like...
Yes.
I believe he would give them some money for it because he seems a jolly sort. And
often quite a thankless... thankless role, Watson, isn't it? And
but he did say he said he would only do it if he wasn't a bumbling fool.
Well, yeah.
And the whole scene, which we come into later with the pee, was something he added himself to try and give him something to do. Weird.
Okay, so
imagine that's the thing that you introduced. Guys, I've been thinking, got this amazing idea.
What's my motivation here?
I've got this bit that shows how kind of... incisive I am when I can't stab a pea.
And Holmes comes and squashes it.
Yeah.
Deary me. So, yeah, it's established very quickly that we're in the midst of Jack the Ripper's reign of terror. Mm. Two people have already been killed. And as it stands at the moment, no one has asked Holmes to help out. However, that situation very quickly changes when he gets a visit from what I've put is the non-existent shopkeepers committee.
Yeah.
Like, I doubt this thing. He's like, we're here from the Committee of Shopkeepers of East London. I was like, well, I very much doubt that ever existed. This is just a plot expedience, isn't
it? And class warfare, mate, isn't it? They come in and they're like,
so these guys turn up at Downing at Baker Street and then say, look, Sherlock Holmes, please help. This is really, really bad. It's affecting our businesses, which again, if you know anything about the Jack the Ripper crimes, and I'm going to come on to talk about the amazing book The Five by Hayley Reubenhold, everybody should read. More on that later.
Yep.
But if you know, read any books like that, you realise it's like what East London and Whitechapel were like. The murders had no effect on the area whatsoever. So again, this like really odd fake image of what London was like at the time.
It's just a hellhole.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
It was just wrong.
He then says, okay, yep, all right. I'll start looking into it.
Yes.
And then we get kind of like some of his original, like Holmesian thoughts about who could be behind it. None of it really comes to anything, does it? And then kind of the Jack the Ripper strikes again. He kills a gin-soaked lady, you know, as we were saying earlier, like, oh, come here, dearie. Oh, yeah. You know, so he strikes again and then... it kind of cuts to Watson having a lovely sleep and sort of Holmes wakes him up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And basically says, wake up, come on, we're going to go look at it. And I'd be really pissed off if I was woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's like, can you not go and have a look and tell me about what you found? And talk about it. I'm really comfy. Oh,
yes.
Oh, man.
But then he's I've written down here that Holmes is constantly, and other characters, constantly sort of implying that Watson is a bit of a ladies man. And,
yes.
And they're kind of like sort of teasing him about it.
You don't see that at any point either, do you?
No, apart from...
Also, one thing I should add is that it's obviously not Baker Street that they're in.
No,
I think everyone knows what Baker
not.
Street looks like.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like Baker Street at all, does it? It's a cul-de-sac.
I've wrote that it looks more like Downing Street.
Yeah.
You see what Downing Street's like for our foreign...
It's region. A street...
It's more like that.
It definitely doesn't have 221... residences in it,
no, it
because
not.
It's got about five houses in it and then it's a dead end, so it's maybe like 5B Baker Street.
And the fact it's a B means it's like probably as in the Gatiss and Moffat version, it's above a shop, you know. But whereas this is like he's got the whole of this mansion pretty much he's living in.
Right, so they then turn up at the so Holmes, now fully on the case, turns up at the latest killing, and there's a lot made of, oh my god, she's been massacred, you know, like her innards have been pulled out and things like that. And I have put down, this is not that, this is just, criticising for the sake of criticising, but I did just put that John Watson is supposed to be, not only is he a medical doctor, but he's a veteran of the Afghanistan war, isn't he? And so yeah, when he's like, exactly. "Oh, like, come on, mate! You would have seen way worse than that.
Yeah.
Way, way worse." That's right.
In a way, Sherlock.
Sherlock. So yeah, I found that didn't really kind of slightly discordant. I thought, yeah, that doesn't work for me. But still, while he's looking at it, and while he's like, "Oh, what's going on here? And is there something in the way that this woman has been carved up?" Question mark. Yes. And then enter Sir Charles Warren and his facial hair. Warren turns up and he's like outraged. Holmes, what are you doing here? And again, he's like, well, surely Sir Charles Warren, real life, you know, Metropolitan Police Commissioner. Holmes was a real guy, you would know that he solves virtually every case.
But they don't want him to. I think that's one thing I liked about this is that if Holmes was a realistic character,
yes,
there would be a thing about why hasn't he solved this crime? And I quite like the fact that it's a Masonic kind of plot that they're trying to keep him out of it, so he doesn't
is
solve
that,
it.
Is that explicit enough, though, Cleese? Or is it just like something you have to kind of make up for yourself?
Because I felt like Charles Warren was very much like, I don't want Holmes on this case. Get him away from here. Don't let him look at anything.
But you don't have any kind of exposition why.
No.
He just comes in and starts shouting. And all I think is, here are some of Britain's greatest drinkers in the late 20th century. And they're all here. They're probably all pissed. Yeah. This is probably 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's the first scene they've managed to get down.
Yeah, that they've all arrived for. They've all got there in time for.
Yeah, but they're all pissed from the night before.
Quite, absolutely. So, I've got nothing more to add to that. But yeah, so then what we get is the famous or the infamous graffiti that was found and removed by the.
So this is real. This is real life, isn't it, James? Which I find interesting.
And this is the point when I thought, oh, I'm going to have to bring up From Hell and talk about From Hell, because what I felt was, not knowing that, you know, that they'd taken Stephen Knight's book from this, I was like, this is really interesting that it's like a lot of the same elements from Hell, but remixed to the most beige facts as possible. So the whole Masonic conspiracy, you know, the police trying to cover things up, all of that stuff, Robert Lee's being involved, all of these things are in From Hell, but in a far more interesting dynamic way.
Yeah, and like, I don't know why Lees is in this film. He doesn't sort of like do it. It doesn't explain like why.
Is this the spiritualist guy?
Yeah.
But they don't explain why he's having visions. And it doesn't help him solve.
And then he's totally forgotten after 30 minutes or something like that. Is he?
Yeah, we got to that bit.
We're coming up to it now.
Yeah, but maybe let's talk about the graffiti though. So the graffiti gets washed away by Sir Charles Warren. Which
Tony Quayle.
But then Holmes comes up with some special liquid which makes it all like glow in the dark.
It's the only bit of Holmesian deduction or kind of trick. It's not a trick though, is it? It's like a scientific thing that he does pretty much in the whole film, which is really disappointing.
Yes.
Because the main thing for me is Holmes comes into a scene and he says, you came on the 9:15 from Paddington, and the guy says, how? And he's like, well, I've seen the salt, the dirt on your shoe. You've got something on your cuff. And you don't get any of that in this, which it really annoyed me, because it's like,
there is no deduction.
Yeah. There's no deduction whatsoever.
He just basically gets a number of clues.
Yes.
He's just given a number of clues, as if any normal policeman would. You know, the way that this woman has been killed. Might this signify something? He does know, as you correctly said, he does no kind of logistical analysis at any point.
He does disguises, though.
We'll come on to that in a second.
Yeah. He does one disguise, which is good.
I always loved it when Nancy Brett did a disguise.
Yeah.
So, yes, so we then get, after that, back at 221B Baker Street, we get the aforementioned pee scene, which goes on for, it seems like, days, Watson is trying to get the last pee on his plate, which is really, really odd with a fork. And then kind of, I thought, to start off with, in the same way I think we've already mentioned, we thought this may come into play later on. And also, you know, there's a really good sequence in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the film version, when they're driving along and there's a wasp in the car. Mm. And
Smiley.
No. So, but first
Tom Hardy?
No, not Tom Hardy. He's abroad. Benedict Cumberbatch. Benedict, yeah. Thank you. Benedict Cumberbatch is like desperately trying to hit this wasp and get it out of the car. And George Smiley just sort of lowers the window and the wasp flies out, you know, thus indicating the different methodologies of the two men. And
Exactly,
maybe this is going to play into their method. But no, it was said it was just a really weird aside that goes on too long.
Bizarre, isn't it?
James Mason likes the feeling of the pee popping in his mouth.
In his mouth. He doesn't. Right? And then we find out that it's very, very similar, that there's a Cockney version of Deep Throat, isn't there? Like, from the Watergate scandal. And like, in Watergate...
Oh, I thought you were talking about a different Deep Throat.
Oh, yeah, no, sorry. As in the Watergate scandal.
Cut that out.
And in that way...
We'll be doing that from next week.
That Bob Woodward had to go and meet Deep Throat in Washington car parks and follow the money, follow the money. You know, all of that business. Holmes has to go down to the docks and from under the docks, a Cockney sort of shouts up clues to him. Again, no deduction going
on whatsoever.
But made
me think of the dock set from the Young Sherlock Holmes where they end up having the fight with Moriarty.
Yes.
But also, an interesting aside... Smoking man in X-Files, who is the kind of Deep Throat character, played Sherlock Holmes in A Study in Terror.
Oh, wow.
It
all ties together.
See that? And I hope Mark Gatiss is listening to see what I did there.
And also,
listen now.
I, again, if people haven't seen Young Sherlock Holmes, watch Young Sherlock Holmes. It's great.
It's aged very, very well. It's far better than this.
And also, the first ever post-credit scenes that I'd ever seen, and still one of the best.
Yeah,
if you haven't seen it, watch it.
I'm getting goosebumps.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Oh, is that when he signs his name Moriarty?
Yeah.
I'm just going to turn around and get my other glass of wine. Hang on, carry on without me.
I'm going to do the same. Wine break.
Hi, it's Ross from the General Witchfinders. Did you know that I also do another podcast with my friend David?
Hello. No, my headphones are full of that. You're not taking this seriously, Ross.
David and I do our own supernatural research and investigations in our home county of Dorset. So, if you think that's up your street, why don't you give it a listen? It's Dark Darset, D-A-R-Z-E-T. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's not mad.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Oh.
Yes. So where are we up to with the film?
Lees. We meet.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Enter Lees. Yeah. But
I've got to say that it's a hard film to follow, isn't it? Because it's not really signposted what the motivation of the characters
are
for each next step. So it's like, well, we're going to go and see this fucking dude now that's telepathic.
It's because he's not solving the crime.
Yeah.
No.
That's the thing. There's no kind of like revelations to say, oh, this clue is leading me to this deduction. And
I want Sherlock Holmes to get some dust on the floor, lick it, taste it, and say... The murderer is X. And then you're like, well, how's he going to prove it? And then he proves it and you're like, wow, this is amazing. Which is Sherlock Holmes. Whereas this...
You could easily replace Sherlock Holmes with any just normal detective.
Yeah, that's the thing, James.
The same thing.
Because it's a great idea initially to have the same Sherlock Holmes in the same universe as Jack the Ripper Murders. And I looked earlier and I think the first... Sherlock Holmes was a year before the actual Jack the Ripper Murders, which was 1887 and 1888. So they are direct contemporaries. So it's a great idea. But then in this case, it's just pissed up the wall to use a
Boris
Johnson.
But what you want to happen is them to both to go through a time portal to like 1989 London,
and be played by Data and Picard.
Yeah, and just be chased around London.
For some reason, and I don't know why, I just thought the Biggles movie. There. What have you
With
done
Peter
to me subconsciously to make me think of the Biggles movie?
Was essentially that's what happens, didn't they?
Yes.
Do you want to be a hero?
So maybe we should watch. a study in terror mm-hmm. and see how that fares with mm. with.
We'll do that on episode 47. Yeah.
Okay. Jesus.
So, so the Deep Throat Cockney tells Sherlock Holmes that he needs to go and speak to Robert Leese. Now, Robert Leese was a real life person. Again, as with many of these characters, really involved with the Jack the Ripper case. He was a psychic, in inverted commas, yes, who was Queen Victoria's psychic. And in and he was, of course, also apparently he was from Bournemouth,
yep.
our home town. So you know, one of the weird links and ties mm-hmm. that Bournemouth has yeah. to the Jack the Ripper case. Because also in real life, the guy who was on the case, Abilene, he was from Dorset. Abilene was Dorset, was a Dorset native, and so if From Hell starts off with the pair of them on the beach at Bournemouth mm-hmm. when they're old
yes.
men.
It does, of course.
Yeah. So anyway,
I haven't read it for years, but yeah.
So, but so by the way, so he then goes to see Robert Leese, and what I have put is Robert Leese's house is lovely. Mm. If ever I win the lottery, I want a house like that. It's a huge,
it's a proper
kind of
house, not a set, isn't it?
Yes, and yes. it's like a Georgian sort of 3-story affair. It's lovely. Anyway, as we mentioned at the start of the or close to the start, by the time Ross is finishing editing this, who knows when it turned up, but still, Sutherland turns up and he's playing his acid casualty figure.
Yes.
Yeah. That, you know, he all looks a bit spaced out, slightly a bit like he were doing a few years afterwards in Kate Bush's cloud busting video. that era.
I think he's a kind of interesting prefigurement of Tom Baker's Fourth Doctor.
Yes. He's got that
he's like the watcher for the Third Doctor, so
he would have been a good American Doctor, wouldn't he?
He would have been a very good American Doctor. Yeah, I can see him with the scarf and the.
Yeah,
he does point in this film as well, in the way that he points in Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I should say Canadian, not American.
Oh, yes, okay. Is he from Canada?
Yeah. Yes, I believe so.
Wow. Yeah.
So Leese gives him some flim-flam about how he's seen these murders happening. And then when he was out on the street, he saw him on an omnibus and sort of chased him. It doesn't really kind of lead anywhere.
And then he goes, but, and I know where he lives, but I'm not going to tell you.
Yeah, so, odd. It's very, very, very strange.
Doesn't make sense at all, does it? But at that point, Sherlock Holmes should know where he lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he should have deduced it. But what we kind of get from it, I suppose, if you're going to say anything, is that it's kind of, he starts to figure out that, you know, like the killer is a part of London society.
Mm.
You know what I mean? He's not so kind of like, oh, okay. And I suppose that then leads him to put two and two together with the way that the last victim has been murdered. He then starts to go, okay, he may be a Mason.
Mm. Yes.
And then what
which is From Hell, is
yes, James, again, yeah, totally, right. Totally, yeah, totally, totally, yes. Yeah. Well, that's the whole thing, is that William Gold was in the Freemasons. And we're talking about
specifically the graphic novel, not the really
the
boring Johnny Depp
film. Oh my God, the film's so bad.
With the girl from Gavin and Stacey.
Really?
Yeah, she's...
Oh, I was about to say Heather
Graham. She's a naked sex worker who goes mad, I think, in one of the...
Which are we talking about?
The main character, I can't believe I've forgotten her name.
Stacey.
Because she went to college with Hell.
Did she?
Queen Elizabeth from...
yes, what's her name?
I don't know, can't remember.
God. Oh, this is what people listen to.
Three middle-aged men clutching in the unknown.
I can't remember the early noughties.
What's her name?
I just remember Ruth
Jones.
Met
her. I probably photographed her. What is her name, Cleves? Please help me.
Alexa, who plays Stacey in Gavin and Stacey?
Stacey Shipman is played by Joanna Page in the show.
Joanna Page. Yeah. So it's Joe Page, who is Joe Page is in From Hell, and it was, I think it was pre Gavin and Stacey. Mm. And at the time, I remember Hell was like, "Oh, Joe Page has got a part." And then when we watched the film, she was like this bald mad woman in Bedlam or somewhere like that. But the Johnny Depp film is a bit of a
isn't it? Yeah.
Don't watch it. Anyway, this is the first point where I've written in my notes, this is mad. Nothing much is actually happening in this film. And then what I've put is, in years past, I used to DJ. Normally on a Saturday night, I could be entertaining people, all dancing about and jumping up in the air through the power of music. Now I am watching a dreadful 70s Sherlock Holmes film for our podcast.
Yes.
I must be cross at Ross.
Well, as I said, I'm not sure I can finish this because life is finite.
Yes, I agree, Joe.
And that sums up this film. Well, it sums up this film until 90 minutes in, which is when pretty much all Hammer films are finished by 90 minutes.
A building's burning down at that point, isn't it?
Hang on. Yeah, they suddenly have this conversation with David Hemmings, and you're like, oh, this has actually got interesting now. And then the last 20 minutes is quite good.
What, the chase, but the chase around.
Yeah, but this, like, up to this point, we're probably an hour in here, are we? Like,
we are.
40 minutes, an hour in.
Well, an hour into the podcast.
And we're just like, what is happening? There's no kind of rhythm or drive to the narrative. No. It's just like, oh, let's go and see this spiritualist. And it's quite, you know, parts of it are interesting because obviously I think 99.9% of the population now have no idea how important spiritualism was to kind of the Victorian and Edwardian.
Hugely popular.
Societies, and if you read short stories from that time, there's so many about kind of seances and people
table tapping and table spinning
and all this kind of stuff, and you think, oh, this part will be interesting now, but then it's totally just forgotten, isn't it, and Donald Sutherland is forgotten, and it's like, you've got Donald Sutherland, you've got him in for a couple of days, he's probably pissed as well. He's probably heard these piss heads are doing it. It's all gone. See those piss heads. But I always think of him in The Eagle Has Landed, where he's very good with Jenny Agutter.
Yeah.
And he's very charming in that. And then does he get machine gunned to death at the end or something, probably?
Like Sid James.
So we get up to, and I put Holmes in disguise, Claxon.
Yep.
Because, and this is a big deal for me, because just once in my life I want to do this. I'm not someone who said like, oh, I want to go paragliding off of the Grand Canyon, or I don't want to do madly dangerous or anything like that. But just once in my life, I'd like to go, oh, could you help an old lady? And have someone go, no, my dear, I haven't got time for you right now. I'm supposed to be meeting someone. And then I go, I remove a false nose and go, ha-ha, sir!
Give someone a
just
gotcha.
Once in my life. That would be amazing. Yeah. I'd love to do that.
Do it to DLT.
Yeah.
I don't know
this
where.
This man dies!
If this is for real, this man dies! One of my favourite things ever, of course.
It's not about kids, okay?
And of course, one of my favourite press conferences of all time there. So yes, come on. Once again, universe, I don't know if there's much scope for a middle-aged
Where would you try and get into,
teacher.
James?
I don't know, John.
Because a lot of it would be seen as being inappropriate these days.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I've had enough.
But I was trying to work out why he was doing it. And it was basically he wanted to go back and see these, but the police were stopping him from going.
Him.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Because I have no idea why he was trying to get in there.
Yeah. And what I put is, this is totally unnecessary. He could just sneak round the back.
Yeah.
It's such a big house.
Yeah.
Just jump over the wall.
But again, they could have made more about the police trying to stop him.
Yes.
They could, because I didn't know that was happening.
Yeah.
So he goes in then, and what happens then? They have a chat.
They do, and there's kind of, it leads to... you might want to start having a look around this pub on Dorset Street, and then Holmes.
Okay, Dorset.
And then having found this out, Holmes says to Watson, go and see if you can find out anything going on in this pub to do with these ladies.
Very strange scene come up now.
And then it's really, really odd. James Mason goes into the pub and gets basically propositioned by a couple of prostitutes.
Yeah.
But allows
her just to feel him up for quite a long time. And then
feel up, she puts her hand on his leg.
Yeah. And then it does agree to go down an alleyway with him. And
right. Where okay. So what? So Watson. No. Hold on. The Watson decides to follow this prostitute to try and get more information out. Down a back alley. At which point he is then ensnared. They kind of close a gate behind him, and then she's like, oh, he was trying to fill me up. You know, and then the line amazingly is, stay there, you pimp, from James yes. Mason. And I've written that down. Stay there, you pimp. And then I've put, Watson has got no time whatsoever for plebs. Yeah. In that he makes short work of this kind of woman's enforcer / pimp.
With his cane. Yeah, and he's got a police whistle, which I thought was quite cool. That he
cool. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And the music then goes, and some black exploitation guys come in and say, hey, man. Yeah, fuck you, or
it's jive turkey.
But it's actually Pete Beale from TV's EastEnders, one of the launch cast. TV's grocer, Pete Beale, is one of the policemen.
I got a vision of him crying in my mind. It must have been quite a impactful performance of
you're not mixing him up with Bill Treacher, are you?
No, but I remember him crying as well, and
yes, and getting smashing all the stuff off the mantelpiece, yeah. And going mental.
Yes,
with locking himself in the outside toilet. I
yes,
because he's stolen the
Christmas Club money.
Yeah,
yes.
So I'm looking at Pete Beale now. Pete Beale is a fictional character played by Peter Dean. Peter Dean is still alive. He's 84.
I like the way that when they started off that they lived in flats. They didn't live on on Albert Square. And that's sort of it got less and less.
I remember the flats.
Yeah,
I remember the flats. The son says that he looks unrecognizable now. He looks literally exactly the same as Pete Beale.
Yeah.
Looks the same as Pete Beale.
They're obsessed with Pete.
Like, dreadful.
They are obsessed.
Remain looking exactly the same all through their lives.
Well, I hate the vast majority of the British press anyway, but this race for clicks.
You won't believe,
you must see. It's just scum.
So we've mentioned Pete Beale.
Yeah.
And last episode, we mentioned Gillian Telforth.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. We're pivoting to an EastEnders podcast.
That was his TV wife, wasn't it?
It was, yes. Wilmot
Brown ruined it all.
It's all tied in together.
In the Dagmar.
Yeah.
Yes.
Remember when the Dagmar burned down? Dirty Dan.
There's going to be more Nick Berry action. What was the name of Nick Berry's kind of like nightclub that he tried to get going?
Oh, I don't know. Well, that's some advantage.
Hang on, go on. Cut this bit out as well. We're asking people die.
No, leave Nick this Berry's. Bit in. Just cut the Googling out.
What, is it real life or this character?
No. His
character,
Wixie sort of ran. He left the Queen Vic. This is the only time I ever watched EastEnders was during this sort of era.
I've written Whiskey. Like
as you said,
I'd say
Wilmot
this
Brown.
Is about 87, 88, yeah. James.
The
so we're talking Christmas.
Happy Christmas, Ange. You know, that the classic era.
This my sweet. I can't believe Grantham is dead. That's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
How do you spell Wixie? Because I'm writing Whiskey.
W-I-C-K-S-Y.
Okay.
What have you written, Cleves?
Whiskey. Yeah.
Yeah. 17 times.
Yeah. It's but now you've got my login to BritBox. You can watch those episodes. They're all on there.
They're on there, are they?
Yeah, they've got the Christmas ones and stuff.
Oh, I was thinking of watching Image of the Fendal.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
With the glowing I've never skull. Seen that one. Yes.
Wasn't Joe Wicks.
What
was it?
Simon Wicks, he was.
Yeah. It's Simon Wicks, thank you.
Mm.
Simon Wixie.
So was he the half brother of Ian Beale?
Oh, the picture of him.
Yes, would have been. It's not coming up on the Wixie Wikipedia page, but he had a nightclub. Mm. So I think he might be getting mixed up.
He didn't. I swear.
Anyone can fall in love.
He settles in New Zealand. Well, I never.
Simon May. We were watching Howard's Way yesterday in this.
Oh, amazing.
Simon May was a big fan of a melody that was based on spelling out the title Howard's Way. E EastEnders, EastEnders, EastEnders. But
and
Howard's
then
Way
that
is
really
amazing.
Upbeat kind of coda music they had on Howard's Way. That with that with the guy who's like the quasi bad guy, like laughing, yes. doing going really fast in his speedboat, right? Around the Solent.
Amazing.
And the, well, but then also sadness because I'm thinking, oh, I've got to go to school tomorrow. But
yes! Yeah. Sunday night, isn't it? Oh, horrible. Yeah, Sunday night.
It has reminded me here that they were in a band, which he was in a band with.
Yes.
And do you remember what the band was called?
Sharon. Oh.
First something?
No, they were called The Band, B-A-N-N-E-D, because they were banned from playing in the...
We're going to get... We're going to make something out of nothing. We're going to turn a spark into a flame. That's all.
Whoa,
I can remember.
James, what's that?
I've dug that. That's what they sang. I've dug that out from somewhere.
Wow. I feel like I can remember
so much stuff about,
the
say, for example... The periodic table from when I was at school. Important things that I wish I knew now. But can I remember fragments of the song that the EastEnders band?
And I've got that Howard's Way music so.
Did you know every Loser Wind knocked Madonna's True Blue off the top
bang.
Slot?
Oh, amazing!
It was the second biggest thing in the UK.
Yeah,
that year after "Don't Leave Me This Way" by the Communards.
What?
So that's 1986, is it, or 87?
It was 86.
BBC Enterprises. They must have loved that BBC Enterprises. That was filling the coffers, wasn't it?
Did you know that Simon Way won an Ivor Novello Award for writing Every Loser Wins?
I'm not surprised.
It's a beautiful melody, isn't it? He was probably declared bankrupt like 3 years later or something, wasn't it?
That's in keeping with the message of the song. Yeah. Right, okay, we got to get this finished.
Yeah.
We've got to get this finished.
Come on,
right?
Let's rattle through. Because fuck all happens.
So, after calling the police to deal with the prostitute pimp situation, basically...
He blows a whistle. He doesn't ring 999.
He blows
But he's already dealt with him by that point. He's got him pinned to the ground.
He's got him pinned to the ground. But the police take the view of the other two, saying, oh, he started on us and what have you, and he gets arrested.
Yeah.
And this is the thing that I tweeted last night. He basically... Holmes goes and springs him out from the cells the next morning. And what I've put is, Holmes is cracking up at Watson's pimp-based arrest.
Yeah.
Just as they're driving home, he's like...
Yeah.
Watson.
I know.
You dickhead. You got on a job that I sent you on. Well done, mate.
So you could have picked me up last night.
Not only in any... It's bad enough, I guess. I pray I never have to spend a night in police custody. But imagine a night in Victorian police custody. And he said, Christopher Plummer is just laughing at him, which seems unfair.
Sorry to interrupt, Ross here, just doing a quick plug. Did you know that we do a range of General Witchfinders t-shirts? Go to generalwitchfinders.com, buy a shirt and help support the show. Thanks.
But I was impressed every time they were out in the carriage, but the amount of extras and other carriages they had around
I
them
put
and
that.
Stuff.
But I think unless London did have that until 1979.
I put that this must have cost a fortune, the amount of extras, stuff like that they've got.
I think in some ways, it does. Yeah. I mean, the main set that we've mentioned does look incredibly expensive and you couldn't make it now.
No.
Although at one
an
point,
fortune to build.
They're at the Royal Naval College in Greenwich, because I used to live there, down the road from that. Which is used in so many films.
Doctor Who's Dimensions in Time, I think it is.
Yes. That's a classic arc, that was.
Well, that which is right next door to it, Ross. It's literally 10 seconds away from it. Anyway,
going back to EastEnders, that was an EastEnders Doctor Who. Crossover.
It was.
Yeah.
What year is this, madam? John Pertwee said to an aged, visibly aged Wendy Richards, who actually in real life was already dead at that point.
Sorry.
John Pertwee. What was his first doctor? Story.
Don't worry about that. As Leslie Grantham said, TV's Leslie Grantham, when he went back, she was the worst wanker.
Is that true? Oh my god.
I'm going to try and Google it now.
Oh my god.
And he's been on Fort Boyard with Amanda.
Amanda Mitchell. Messenger.
Melinda Messenger. And a load of French dwarfs. And,
I remember that.
And Tom Baker.
Really?
Tom Baker was up the tower, wasn't he? Doing the quizzes things.
I really hope this is the first episode that Mark Gatiss listens to.
Oh, we're so sorry.
You need to put this at the start, please.
The man's a legend. Anyway.
So I've put in Leslie Grantham, the worst wanker.
Oh, set me off.
She was God, so, carry on. Carry on. Don't wait for me.
She was so tanned. If you look at
like a 70s leather couch.
But what she looked like when she started, and that when EastEnders was realistic and they looked like people from the
East.
They just end up becoming like super tan, massive long fingernails.
You're listening to the EastEnders cast. the Albert Square talk around or whatever. Anyway, right. So meanwhile, what we have to say is, having sprung Watson out of jail, Holmes then manages to locate Marie Kelly, who is famously Jack the Ripper's last victim, or was it Jack the Ripper? More on that when we get right to the end. It was horribly, horribly butchered. But what I've put is, for the first time in this film, hey, that actually is Clink Wharf, where he meets her. That's the right location. That's actually Clink Wharf. Just in case anyone, I can't imagine anyone listening to this podcast think after what we've said about this film goes, well, Mark, watch this. But should you ever find it on, look out. That actually is Clink Wharf. They've obviously, since they filmed this in the 70s, have gentrified it up a fair old bit. But it is the old location of an old London prison, the Clink.
And it's also featured in TV's Doctor Who, Resurrection of the Daleks.
Yep. Wow, okay.
Yeah,
there
where
you
a
go.
Dalek is
Chucked
where a Dalek
the...
is pushed pushed out of a window or door.
Good. And what I've noticed is, and I said, bearing in mind what we did last time, that in this scene, Marie Kelly looks like the woman in black.
Mm, yes, definitely.
And she's really pale and drawn in the way that she's dressed.
Apparently, this bit where they get chased by the carriage, that this is the only point they use any stunt performers in the film.
Wow.
Apparently.
Well, I've put, it's yet another film where avoiding a horse is impossible. talking about the oblong box, where, of course, a horse was coming from about 3 miles away and they couldn't get out of the way. Again, with this, I was like, you could easily get out of the way of that. Anyway, yeah, so a horse and carriage almost knocks them over. Mm. And Holmes realizes, oh, wait a minute, somebody
wants
Holmes
this gets knocked
dead.
Down, doesn't he?
He does. And then she basically says, oh, you've got to go and find Annie Crook, and you'll find Annie Crook in this asylum. Mm-hmm. So he heads off to the asylum. And now, of course, this is the whole From Hell story, the suggestion that the man who was booed in our opening sequence, Prince Eddie, Queen Victoria, the heir to the throne, that he had had an affair with a shop girl. In the East End, he had had an illegitimate child.
No, he was at Pizza Express.
Hey, satire. A little bit of satire. Two bits of satire in one go. Good. Yeah. Well done, Ross.
Thank you.
All right. So thus giving us our title of the film, it is by the royal decree, the royal order, that this woman be neutralized, that her child has been taken off of her and she has been chucked in a madhouse, which is exactly what happens in From Hell as well. Because
in 2004, Richard was referred to as the worst wanker of them all during Leslie Grantham's now infamous webcam chat.
With Jason Orange.
Now infamous.
To an undercover reporter. So that, why that has stayed in my head from 2004, 19 years, that she was called the worst wanker of all. The worst wanker of all, James. Out of all of them.
It's written on a gravestone. Do you know that?
Oh, dearie me. Oh, my gosh. I'm also thinking about when they killed off Dirty Den. That's one of the other times I've seen it, when he was killed, but shot by that guy with the silencer. Pew! And then...
The daffodils, wasn't it?
Out of the daffodils, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, I think
the subtitle for this episode is Worst Wanker, so I'm going to write
the Worst Wanker of all.
Oh, my God. Right, okay, so at this point, and again, this is also another scene when it seems that Christopher Plummer seems to be quite drunk, that he goes from being, like, very calm and loving to suddenly, like, enraged.
Yeah.
How dare you do this to this woman? It goes a bit nuts.
Yeah.
And what have you. And also I put, oh, my God, it's Genevieve Boujold, who... What is she, Ross? What did we say?
What has she been in?
Lots of like sort of sci-fi horror-y things in the 70s. People should
Dead Ringers, Coma.
Ah, Cronenberg.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
Yes.
Ross, did David Cronenberg's make a did David Cronenberg's son make a film?
I was trying to remember the name of that film earlier.
Possessor.
He did it, John!
Oh my God.
But I was saying, John, when we used to do this podcast, I used to drink a bottle of wine to do it. Now I eat a yogurt.
You know, good. Good.
For the best.
Possessor.
Right. Okay, so while Holmes is making his way back, he suddenly realizes that what the deal is, and that the women that knew that Annie Crook had this baby, they were from hell in the comic. They put a blackmail claim into to Queen Victoria. Do they make it explicit that that's what they've done here?
Well, no, because that's what I was going to say. That all the way through this film, it was like, am I understanding what's happening in this film, or is it just me thinking of From Hell?
Yes.
And just pushing that on top of this.
Because beige version of From
Exactly,
Hell.
Because it was like, it was similar to watching Women in Black, where it's like, I'm not sure how well this is putting across the story, because I know the story from the other version of the film.
It was
a very kind of strange experience, because I was always like ahead of what was happening, or knowing more about what was happening than they were actually putting across.
Maybe like a spiritualist, Cleves.
Yeah. But, okay, we must be near the end of this film now.
We are. Because then it's now the Marie Kelly murder.
Yeah.
And all I've just put is crash zooms ahoy.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's that Holmes figures out that she's in danger, and so he's sort of rushing back from the asylum to try and get to her. Whilst meanwhile, the Gull stand-in and the Netley stand-in start to kill, you know, turn up, surprise her, kill her, and there's lots of kind of crash zooms.
But they're making out like it's a rush to rescue her, but she's been killed already.
She's already dead.
Yeah, and they're just doing a very, very long sort of cutting her up. But I thought it was quite interesting that they have the fire blazing, because this is the one where it was famously they had a fire blazing to such a high heat that he burnt the heart on there.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And I thought that was quite... and I was wondering, is Holmes going to get in through the broken window? Because there was famously a broken window and everything on that. But what was... There was a whole sort of... Something going on with that policeman, wasn't it? Out of blow up. There was a big revelation at this point.
Well, that's where it starts to get interesting, is that he's part of some kind of proletariat conspiracy to get rid of the corrupt establishment.
Right, so he
which
was trying
I was
to...
Like, oh, so this, he... so this... Yeah. So they were... They... how he was going to do that, I'm not quite sure.
Well, wasn't he trying to make it so the crime wasn't solved, so that the people of Whitechapel would rise up against the police or something?
Maybe yes, but I thought if it was solved, that would mean that you know, people would go to jail.
Yeah, and also they could then say it was the royal family who did this.
Well, exactly. It doesn't make much sense.
But then does he get killed on a...
He then gets killed by one of the Jack the Rippers, which is good.
Yeah.
And then from there on, the film starts to like get some pace and story.
There's a chase that follows.
But doesn't he get killed on a sword? Because I got on here.
Yes.
Man impaled on a slides off of a sword. How did they do that? Because it looked really realistic to me. There was a...
Yes, it did. But that's earlier on where the man in the boat gets run through with the cane.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah.
So it's like a rapier in a cane, isn't it, where he pulls it out.
Yeah.
I don't know how they did that, because it did look like it had gone into his middle, didn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
So there's a chase then, isn't there? But basically, there the doctor, who was their version of Gold, which is just left in the room. He's kind of gone insane.
He looks mad.
Yeah. And the Netley version is just like running around
Yes, he looks like Joss Ackland or someone, doesn't he?
It is, and what I put is these are very, very deserted Whitechapel streets.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's nobody on them whatsoever.
There is that part, yeah.
Yeah. And ultimately, when they sort of face off, there's a physical altercation between the two of them, and the Netley analog is that was standing is killed by netting.
Yeah,
he falls into a cargo net weirdly, and then gets his head stuck between, you know, kind of like one of the bits of the cargo net, and then just goes.
Yeah,
I was like, you could have easily extracted yourself from that.
And then Holmes is just pointing at it, isn't
him.
It? Yeah.
Yes.
And then you think, is that the end? And then...
And my note says, my God, still 20 minutes to go.
Yes.
Because that feels like the end of the film.
Well, no. It does. Yeah, it's like a false ending, isn't it?
But don't worry, dear listener. This isn't going to take us 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Because now all that you get is... Okay, is that Johnny Gielgud turns up to classy this thing up. As we said at the start, he turns up as the Prime Minister. Holmes is seen in Westminster... In Westminster with Sir Charles Warren and the Prime Minister, and basically he explains the plot to, you know, just in case anybody missed it, the whole here's what I've deduced happened, although he hasn't really deduced any of this, and he's like, that's what happened here. And I can't, even though I only watched it last night, I can't remember why they just kind of go, well, okay then.
Yeah.
Why don't they just let him walk out? And why doesn't Holmes decide to expose this? Yeah.
I
can't remember. But basically said, you need to get that woman out of the sign. And he said, oh, she's dead already. And then
Yes.
And that's it. That is Murder by Deer Creek.
I was just going to finish off. I mentioned it probably close towards the start. Is that rather than watching this dreadful, dreadful film, what I recommend everybody does is that everyone should read The Five by Hayley Reubenhold.
Yes,
it's a terrific book. It's one of these things I think I would have read it in one sitting if adult life didn't have to get in the way. I think I've read it in two. And number one, it will make you very, very grateful that you weren't alive in the Victorian era.
Yeah,
it was fucking miserable existence. And what she argues is that. They probably weren't actually prostitutes, is that that's how they were labeled at the time. And not only that, it's like they are just forgotten by history and that they are people with their own identity.
But every single one of that, each one of their lives would be a film in its own.
Oh my God, like you can't believe. Mm. And she doesn't explicitly spell it out, but Marie Kelly, the last victim, she escaped from Paris. And apparently, you know, this was a regular thing, is that, you know, women who were prostitutes were often sort of like press ganged to go and be prostitutes overseas. And because they didn't have any money, they couldn't escape. And she had escaped from Paris, and kind of Hayley Reubenhold suggests that, well, maybe she wasn't actually killed by Jack the Ripper. It was a revenge killing. Okay. So, you know, bear in mind the amount of tosh, which once again, read From Hell, Dance of the Gold Catchers, the final chapter of From Hell, where Alan Moore goes on about the fact that there's an infinite amount of theories about Jack the Ripper. This is by far the best. And I felt it only fitting that I read this bit from it, just to sell it to you. Today, there is only one reason why we would continue to embrace the belief that Jack the Ripper was a killer of prostitutes, because it supports the industry that has grown in part out of this mythology. There's no doubt that the story of Jack the Ripper is a good yarn. It's a gothic tale of a monster on the loose stalking the dark streets of fog-clouded London. It contains suspense and horror and an element of sexual titillation. Unfortunately, this is also a one-sided story, and the hunt for the killer has taken centre stage. Over the centuries, the villain has metamorphosized into the protagonist, an evil, psychotic, mysterious player who is so clever that he's managed to evade detection even today. In order to gulp and examine this miracle of malevolence, we have figuratively stepped over the bodies of those he murdered, and in some cases, stopped to kick them as we walk past. The larger his profile grows, the more of these victims seem to fade. With the advance of time, both the murderer and those he murdered have become detached from reality. Their experiences and names have become entwined with folklore and conspiracy theories. To some merchandisers, they are no longer human beings, but cartoon figures whose bloody images can be printed onto t-shirts, whose deaths can be laughed about on postcards, and whose entrails decorate stickers. Is it any wonder that there has been no public appetite to examine the lives of the canonical five when they have never seemed real or of any consequence to us before? So respect to Hayley Reubenhold. Read this book. And also, this film is a perfect example of it. It said oh, are you all right there, dearie? You know, his victims are, you know, Marie Kelly is, they're just sketches at best.
One of the most powerful bits in that book is they got a list of what was in the pockets of each of the victims.
God, that's the end.
It just makes them into read it. Real people.
Don't watch this film. Read The Five by Hayley Reubenhold or From Hell, which is the better version of this.
Yes.
So what do we think? What are we going to give
it? I've already put it on there. For the last 20 minutes, I'd probably say 2. For the rest of it, I'd say -5.
So that gives it, if you put that all together, what does that mean?
-2.
Okay. All right.
I've given it 1 because as a historical curio and the fact that it said it's like the beige version from Hell, which I love. So it's just really interesting to see these elements recombined. And I really like Donald Sutherland's house and facial hair.
Mm. I'm going to give it a 1 for James Mason. Because I thought he was, he was a brilliant Watson. I agree. I agree for Christopher Plummer, who's one of my least favourite Holmes.
Not the least. I can't think of a worse.
Drunk Holmes. Yeah.
Whereas
Robert James Downey Jr.
Oh, I've never watched that. Yeah. Cool. So that was Murder by Decree. I can't remember what it was called.
Right. Next.
That was quite long. So, James has got a something horrific. If you want to talk about that, quickly.
Something spooky. Yeah. I'm going to talk about it very quickly. We've mentioned her on this podcast before. The Queen of England, as far as I'm concerned, the new PJ Harvey album.
Oh, very good. I've listened to parts of it, but not all of it yet, James.
It's really, really good. It's called Ironside: The Old Year Dying. And for those of us, two of us here are born of the Dorset soil. And all I'll say is there's ghosts involved, the Chalky Children of Evermore. Mm. And there's some terrifically spooky stuff in this. And her voice is amazing. And I'm going to see her in September. Amazing. Yeah, I managed to get tickets for the Roundhouse gig. So,
Brilliant.
Just if you like a bit of folk horror-y or kind of folk ghosty stuff, also, if you just like PJ Harvey anyway, if you like good music, it's a terrific album. So there you go. That's my
Well, I've got something I can terrific. Pop in. I watched In Cold that's Blood the other night.
Oh, yes. What, the Truman Capote?
The Truman Capote film, but it's the 1960, is it 1968? Yes. Something like that.
Black, 67, I
67,
think.
67, yeah. I was basically, do you know on Twitter for the Criterion, they got this cupboard, haven't they, with all the Criterion collection.
With everything in it.
Yeah, and they let filmmakers go in there and pick their favourite films. And there was someone on there, and I didn't even catch who it was, but he said that this is the best shot black and white film ever made. So I watched it, and it is it's amazingly shot. It looks incredible. But it's very, very... It was strange to me that what they was really trying to sell how realistic this film was. And if you watch the trailer, they're just saying, this is actually filmed in the house where the murders were.
Oh my God,
happened.
Really?
They said, when they show the trial, 9 of the people in the playing in the jurors are actual jurors from from the actual trial. And I was just thinking, and they were just like showing, and part of the trailer was like showing the actors next to the photographs of the people who actually did the killings to show how much they looked like. So they were really trying to make this as realistic as possible. But I was thinking, how macabre must it have been to be in making that film, reenacting the killings in the actual rooms where they actually occurred. But I would say it's really powerful, worth watching, and a really realistic hanging sequence in it, which was like, I feel quite uncomfortable watching that. But very good. Worth watching.
John?
Right.
On that bombshell.
So, next time. Oh,
what's next, Cleves?
Okay,
gone very loud, Cleves.
All right, sorry. Well, you've got a choice. Right, the choice.
Choice?
Yes, because we were going to be watching The Innocents.
Oh, yes.
So that was but we have been also be talking about maybe watching a Bond film as Bond film as a horror film. So I've got the fucking lost a bloody p- page of it on?
Flip a coin. Flip a coin.
No, it's the one with this voodoo one.
Live and Let Die.
Yeah.
I'd rather watch the sequences than the whole film, because Live and Let Die is very boring.
Okay.
Take this honky outside and waste him.
Okay, so should we watch The Innocents? But then maybe we would do a... if we can find some of the sequences from certain Bond films, we can do that as well.
Yes, I'll try and remember what the sequences are, because they're quite specific. So a couple of them are in Moonraker.
Yeah.
There's Jaws as well in Spy Who Loved Me. Yeah, okay. I'll try and think what the sequences are.
Just one episode of all of the... rather than... One whole Bond.
Yeah, okay.
All right, but so we'll do The Innocents and then do the Bond sequences.
Okay. So we're on Twitter, General Witch numeral one.
Yeah.
So if we've already had some people tweet us some of their horror scenes from Bond films, but if you can think of any other ones, tweet us and we will add them if we think they're horrific enough.
Yes, I didn't agree with any of the ones I read.
So. Okay, but until next time.
Yes. Thank you for listening and thank you for enduring this. Well, we hope we've made it more entertaining than probably actually the film itself. But thank you, dear listener, as always, for taking time out of your day to listen to this rambling.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. Well, happy day.
Yeah.
You're all the worst wankers, guys.
You have been listening to The General Witchfinders. Support the show and continue the conversation at patreon.com/generalwitchfinders. Subscribe and spread the word at generalwitchfinders.com. Farewell, and don't have nightmares.
Nearly every sentence, John was like, because he was almost like you couldn't believe what the story, what the plot was. There was like this inner turmoil. It was a good thing.
Oh, I love. I remember not being very nice about that film, but then when I think back about all those films, I'm so fond of them.
Yeah.
Mm.
The red faced man, like running in and out of that pub
with
like,
carpet. All
the carpet. Yes.
The Crimson Hood.
Yes. Like cuddling up to harlots and then like stabbing them, and it's just very weird, isn't it?
Well, there's a scene in the Oblong Box which is pretty much in this film as well, isn't there? But,
they're all it's in all those films. Yeah. All right, lovely. Yeah. Who are you looking for?
Come on,
etc. etc.
etc.
Come on with me, I got all my own teeth.
We're ladies of the night.
Yeah.
I've only got 2 pages of notes because this was
such a weird film.
And I've done it on a page, and then I've done it on a page. I haven't done it on the other side of the page. I don't know why I've done that. That's annoying. Yeah, it's such a weird film, James. It didn't get going until its 90th minute. And I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. I was skipping. It's like, this is just... him just talking to the mad woman and oh Jesus.
Right.
A couple of my notes keep saying like there's still an hour to go. Still 20 anyway. Half an hour. Yeah, exactly. It's like when
I did do it in two sittings.
Oh wow. Okay.
Yes.
It's
taken me 4 days to watch Tenet this week before because I'm so busy and I can't sit down to watch a film because I've got so much.
But Christopher Nolan films are so fucking long anyway, aren't they?
But it just made it absolutely incomprehensible. I had no idea what was happening because it was just like, got to the end and I was like, I've no idea what just happened there because none of it made sense anyway. I think if I watched it in one go, it wouldn't make much sense. But watching it in 4 installments, I was like, who are these people? Why do they care?
I imagine having breaks in between it allows your brain to sort of like go, hang on, this is probably...
totally implausible.
Yeah, whereas if you're watching it... I mean, the first time I watch it, I find a lot of films in general now, it's like, that's all right, but I'm never going to watch that again. Like when I went to the new Spider-Verse film, I thought this is one of the most beautiful Like,
yeah.
Insane looking things. There's so much stuff I'm missing because it's going so fast and it's so packed with like detail and everything. And I'm like, I'm never going to watch it again because it's just like,
it's too much.
Way too fucking long. It's just, why do films have to be this long?
Well, I say that. That Oppenheimer is really, really good.
Oh, I would like.
Yes, well, that's why I was watching Tenet to kind of.
It's not a sequel.
Smooth me in,
right?
And also, as I put on Twitter, I have now decided that, like, if you go into a cinema that's got the reclining chairs, that is the way forward, lads. Because I've noticed this is that when Kirsty and I went to see Spider-Verse, Ross, we had the reclining chairs, and then I felt so good afterwards because my legs didn't ache. No, I did have a sleep. I swear I didn't. And it's the same with Oppenheimer. It is kind of like a TV mini series, you could see it as, you know, like three 1-hour. Series, easy. They could do it like that, but you do have to see it in the cinema. The sound is amazing. Yeah. What he's done with the sound, when he starts freaking out about stuff, how they like the oppressiveness of sound. And you think, well, I wouldn't get this even with a decent soundbar. But you're quite right. Films are too long.
I would say, if I was a cinema, we're not going to show any films over 90 minutes long.
Because if you were a cinema, if I was a cinema, transformed yourself into a steel and brick,
and people came inside me and watched things projected on the inside of my body,
yeah.
But that's true. They can't be making money on films that long, you know. You can't get sell enough tickets, and
it was packed today. Yeah. I know it's the whole Barbie thing as well. Absolutely rammed.
Oh, God, I'm thinking of going tomorrow because I think like a Monday afternoon.
Yeah, yeah.
It's likely to be less busy. Mm. I just thought the weekend would be too much. Well, I haven't been to the pictures for, can't remember the last thing I saw on a cinema screen. It might be about that lady that lived in a motorhome and drove across America.
Ennis Men?
Oh, Ennis Men, yeah. Yes, it was that. But before that, it was the lady in the camper van that drove across America. Is it Frances McDormand? That was the last thing.
Yeah.
Long time ago.
Right. Talking of films, I'm recording, yeah. Yeah. I can remember trying to watch remember like BBC4 were doing these sort of like biopics.
Yes,
There
was like a good.
It was
one.
Was on the other night. The Frankie Howard one is David Walliam.
But I was trying to watch it streaming, and it just paused on the scene where he was having a wank. And
it
was just taking fucking eight. I was watching David Walliam as Frankie Howard having a wank for about 20 minutes, just like
take all this out. This is disgusting.
We'll leave it in the end.
Yeah, we might have younger people listening to this. Yeah.
What younger person is listening to a podcast where we're discussing Max by Grace and Frankie Howard?
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Nothing. You have to take the chance to make it right. And suddenly you're no one. Will be someone special to you.
Right, everyone. That sounded quite a bit better, insofar as a song like that could sound better. But you'll know my feelings on the song, so I won't go into that.
Come on, Harry, stop staring. Things are just getting boring.
Yeah, belt up.
Sorry, all I said was it sounded better.
Meaning
no offence or anything, Wixie, but it just proves my point that since we've got the keyboard sound, we don't actually need you live.
What, you mean you don't need me in the band?
Right, and let's face it, you do tend to make the odd boo.
Look, there's nothing wrong with my keyboard plan now, and you know it. You're trying
to make
trouble.
For God's sake, Wixie,
you're trying to make trouble, so it's my song and not yours.
Oh, right? Dear, no wonder you never lasted in any of your other bands. If you get this emotional...
Oh, why don't you shut up, Harry, eh?
Oh, was a trifle unnecessary.
Oh, that was a trifle unnecessary. I do love the way you speak, you little poser.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're nothing, you know. You don't know nothing about music, do you? That's why you can't stand having me around. You've got a nasty, sneaking feeling I might just see right through you, yeah?
Wixie, we all
it's
think
too
you're...
true, mate, I do. Because you're nothing with your ridiculous accent. I don't know what you're trying to be, mate, but I tell you what you are. A silly little jumped-up public schoolboy, that's what you are.
Yeah, Wixie.
Playing at being working class. Playing at being a socialist. Playing at being this big pop impresario. Yeah, and you, right, you're supposed to be my mate, ain't you? I got you in this band, remember? So much for Larty, eh? And the same goes for you, Kelvin. Look at old Sven Garley there to see what to do, eh? Lick his boots. Well, I've got news for you. The sun does not shine out of his bum. You've been sadly misled, Kelvin. Right, well, it's him on me, right? Because I don't want to work with him, not even if he goes down on his bended knee.
Right. Right. If that's the way you feel, no problem. Have fun with your little band, boys and girls. I'll see you on plus.
Oh, no, hang on a minute, Harry. Surely we can work this out, can't
Come
we?
Come on, Harry, we need
no,
you.
No, it's all right, it's all right. I'm going.
No me, and no keyboard, right? And definitely no song. Because this little song here belongs to me, all right? Cheers.